Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm coming to you from snowy Washington, D.C., and hoping that if you are home because of some winter weather event, you are comfortable. If you are braving a storm somewhere today, all goes well in your travels, depending on where you are. Tell us about your community. Do you live in a snow-toughened landscape where snow days are always work days and nobody stays home when the roads ice up? Or are you the resident of some snow-averse community where a hint of winter causes things to close up and kids are told to stay home, no school? Later in the show, a famous former resident of Chicago, you may be able to guess who I'm talking about, does a little White House head-scratching over why the federal government had to shut down yesterday because of a snowstorm. We have conversations this hour about a surprising congressional initiative to actually fix something. But we're going to begin with more signs that the upcoming Winter Olympics will be a showcase for Russia's security forces and a showcase for Russian President Vladimir Putin's broader ambitions in Europe. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, it was originally set up as a strategic alliance to contain Russian ambitions for expansion in Europe. Today, though, NATO is more concerned with Afghanistan. NATO forces are part of the coalition fighting the Taliban. But will that focus have to change now? On Tuesday, President Obama spoke with Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, offering the full assistance of the White House in dealing with terrorist threats in advance of the Sochi Winter Games. Putin has ordered a call-up of tens of thousands of security personnel to raise the police presence in Russia for the Games to basically twice what Britain had in place for the London Summer Games 2 years ago. Once upon a time, Soviet Russia considered its control of Eastern Europe an essential buffer against foreign threats. And today, there is trouble in the old buffer zone. In Ukraine, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned that protests in Kiev are getting out of control. We've had reports of the first fatalities of protesters. Instability in Eastern Europe was the focus for NATO when General Wesley Clark was the NATO's Supreme Allied Commander back in the 90s. In a wide-ranging conversation in Washington about Europe, intelligence gathering, and the future of the Pentagon, Clark said that Vladimir Putin's designs on Ukraine were apparent to him more than two decades ago at the inauguration of Ukraine's then-president, Leonid Kuchma, when Putin was just the Russian prime minister. Clark recalled clearly something Putin said about the relationship between the two countries.
Ukraine and Russia are more than brothers. We are in each other's souls. The Polish National Security Advisor came to me when I was at NATO and said he was very worried about this because it indicated the pattern of Russian effort and that they would attempt to regain control of Ukraine. There's been a number of economic ploys done this, and throughout Eastern Europe, we know that there's a certain effort that's underway by Russian intelligence services working through a number of different channels that make democracy difficult to function. It's not necessarily that they want to take over the country or even to destabilize it. They want it in their orbit. They still play geostrategic chess. We don't, but they do.
We'll hear more of my conversation with General Wesley Clark in just a moment. But first, let's turn to Andrew Weiss, Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, former staff member at the National Security Council. Andrew Weiss, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So what do you make of General Clark's suggestion that Vladimir Putin still thinks of Eastern Europe as something of a buffer zone and that Russians generally are inclined to be very, very worried about what's going on in Ukraine?
I think what's going on in Ukraine is quite dramatic at the moment. The situation we've seen today in terms of reports of people being killed, of the police and the army moving on these protesters who've been camped out in the center of Kiev, very alarming. The question of who's responsible and why things have come to this, I think, is murky at this point. I think we know that there's been a dramatic battle underway in terms of a country that is split. There are two parts of Ukraine. There's a part of the country which wants closer relations with Russia, and then there's a less urbanized part of the country in the West which wants a sort of more European outlook. But to sort of say this is all part of some big geopolitical conspiracy and that there's this big geopolitical battle, I think, is a bit of a stretch.
Although, if things get unstable in Ukraine, is it the case that Vladimir Putin has a tradition of thinking of this part of the world as his sort of strategic playground, that they would be inclined to take unilateral action in Ukraine where they might not elsewhere in the world?
The Ukrainian government for the past 20 years has been very adept at using both sides, both the West and the Russians, to wheedle as many credits, cash, and concessions out of both, and to basically muddle along. And what seems to have happened this time was really part of that playbook. The president of Ukraine is facing re-election. He's very unpopular. The country's economy is in terrible shape. And he basically played both sides off against each other in the hope of getting as much support as he could for his own re-election campaign. What happened in the week since that set of deals were struck is that the situation on the ground got more and more tense. The government kept pushing the demonstrators to clear the square, and then things seemed to have just gotten out of control over the past couple days. Go ahead.
Andrew Weiss, what do you think the Olympics does to either exacerbate this, intensify this, or any other conflict going on in Russia right now?
I think that everything in Russia has been basically put on hold to get ready for these Olympic Games. Putin sees them as a showcase both for Russia's role on the international stage, but also as a way to demonstrate to the Russian people that he's delivering for them. I think in the end, this has proved to be probably a counterproductive move for Putin in the sense that Russia has had to pour tens of billions of dollars into the Sochi Games to try to get things ready, to try to build the infrastructure down there. And then, as you rightly pointed out at the top of the segment, to build the security structures in the region to create an atmosphere that the games can unfold peacefully. This is a tough neighborhood, and doing that with any level of confidence is going to be very challenging for the Russians.
And even though it's expensive, the Russians can afford it with oil prices this high. Andrew Weiss, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Andrew Weiss is Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and former staff member at the National Security Council. In our conversation yesterday, retired Army General Wesley Clark spoke about changes in Russia and Eurasia and wondered whether the U.S. is keeping up with those changes. He spoke about the difficulties of getting the Pentagon to change with the times. And in speaking about U.S. intelligence gathering in the wake of the NSA controversies and the Edward Snowden revelations, General Clark, who was once a Democratic Party presidential candidate, said surprisingly that he believes Americans put aside privacy in favor of electronic surveillance a long time ago.
I think that most Americans had an understanding that there was no privacy. But I think what's different is now it's been confirmed. And when you confirm it, it changes the quality of the expectation. Before you thought, if anything I put in writing, anything I say, there's someone could be listening. Now you know they are listening, or at least have the capacity to do so. Now, when all of this broke, the reaction I got from most people was, so what? Not doing anything wrong. If listening to me makes America safer, let them listen. And so I think it's been difficult for the public outrage to be built on this. I think most Americans still say, well, the government's responsible for security. If this is what's required to secure us, okay. And I think in America today, the need for security is a compelling need. Look at it this way. Over 30,000 people a year are killed in fatal highway accidents. Almost 40,000 people are killed with guns. And it happens every day. It's reported every day. And nothing's done about it legislatively. People don't lose their offices because of it. But the tolerance for a significant terrorist incident is zero.
You've known Bob Gates, former defense secretary, for quite a long time. His memoir seems to describe a very frustrating experience in government, dealing with the government the way it operates today, even given his power at the Pentagon and in the intelligence establishment. Are you sympathetic with his frustrations, and do you think you would be as frustrated if you were in the same position that he was in two administrations?
Oh, I don't know that I could characterize the emotions that way or predict my own reactions to it. But I think it's a fascinating, it's a compelling as well as a candid memoir because, as he acknowledges, he's fighting to get things done. Now, Secretary Gates was previously in the intelligence business. And so even as the director of the CIA for a period in the first Bush administration, he probably didn't have the same execution problems that those of us who've been in the military and worked in the Pentagon have grown up suffering. There's no question. This is a very difficult system to move. I thought it was just heart-wrenching to see how difficult it was for him to move, for example, to the mine-resistant armored protection vehicles, the MRAPs, that he managed to persuade Congress to give him the money for, and we bought them in the thousands and saved young men and women's lives and limbs with these, and it was exactly the right call. Of course, he's exactly right when he says that the Pentagon is, most of it when he got there, they weren't focused on the war, they were focused on the next war. Well, that's also part of the Pentagon's job. He said he was the only guy who was really focused on winning this war. So I think one of the strongest parts of the memoir is how Bob Gates was able to rise above the position. We have to thank him for it.
Do you agree that the mission in Afghanistan was unclear to him and that he was very troubled at not being able to convey that to the president?
Since I wasn't there, it's a little hard for me to get into the details of this. I think when he conveys President Obama's attitude and said maybe he wasn't, you know, fully committed to the mission as I thought he should be or something, if that was the implication in the book, I think, you know, it could have been an entirely different impression that Obama was giving off. For anyone who's president of the United States and sending men into war, especially into something that's a counterinsurgency, where you've got a huge country and you know that you don't have enough troops to really do the job, and even if you did have enough troops, you don't have enough of the rest of the stuff. You don't have enough trainers, you don't have enough agriculture specialists, you don't have enough education people, and even more than that, it takes three generations to change people's attitudes. Whether it's attitudes toward voting, attitudes toward the desegregation and voting acts that went through the South, or something like the Vietnam carryover and how it's affected our population. These are not things that can be solved by a Madison Avenue campaign, by young social workers coming up and saying, patting on the back, say, hey, haven't you changed your mind? And they certainly can't be solved by 19 and 20-year-old Marines and paratroopers in Kevlar and sunglasses who can't speak the language.
In Afghanistan.
I think the president understood all of that when he had to make those decisions. He picked the least bad option, but that doesn't mean it's a good option. And I think that it's a tribute to Bob Gates. He saw it. It's a tribute to Barack Obama. He felt it, if that's what he felt.
General Wesley Clark was NATO's Supreme Allied Commander from 1997 to 2000. He now works as an advisor to the Global Panel Foundation and the National Security Network. He's also chairman of the investment bank, Rodman & Renshaw. Still to come, what did President Obama think about yesterday's snow day in Washington, D.C., and how the nation's capital responds to some flakes of snow? Coming up next, can Congress revisit the Voting Rights Act and update something the Supreme Court struck down last year? That's all coming up here on The Takeaway. And now a non-weather Washington, D.C. story. When the Supreme Court declared the formula that the federal government used to regulate voting practices under the Voting Rights Act outdated and struck it down last June, the Roberts Court allowed for the possibility that Congress might come up with a new formula not based on 50-year-old approaches to racial segregation. Politicians at the time, some even on this program, doubted whether the current Congress would go anywhere near this issue. But a bipartisan group of lawmakers has introduced a new bill that takes up some of the issues identified in the Supreme Court's June decision, Shelby County versus Holder. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, welcome.
Hi, John.
Braving the snow to get here. It's great to have you here, Todd. Also joining us from snowy WGBH in Boston is Aaron O'Brien, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Aaron, welcome.
Pleased to be here.
All right, Todd, let me begin with you, the coalition. How surprising is it? Give me the casting here.
The coalition itself is not terribly surprising, but to have such a bipartisan group in this Congress certainly is. You've got Pat Leahy, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, liberal and civil libertarian. Then his counterpart from the House, well, not the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, which is a factor, but the longtime chairman, James Sensenbrenner, conservative of Wisconsin, but a champion of the Voting Rights Act, joining in. You've got a few others, notably John Lewis, the famous civil rights activist and leader from Georgia, longtime longtime congressman, is also on board, and a couple of other liberals and conservatives signing on as co-sponsors. So the coalition is notable. Getting it passed is another issue, but the fact that you have this broad bipartisan, sort of ideologically bipartisan group is definitely a thing.
Aaron O'Brien, what do you make of the approach here to try to come up with a formula that I suspect would be a new national sort of a preclearance kind of formula? Preclearance, if you could explain that term, which was actually part of what the Supreme Court struck down in the Voting Rights Act.
Sure. The idea behind preclearance is that sort of the usual suspects when it comes to voting rights infringements, especially for minorities and African Americans, would have to go to the feds first. If they were going to make some sort of change to their electoral laws, they'd have to go to the feds before they implemented it. What the Supreme Court said is they don't have to do that anymore. And as Todd said, most of us thought, okay, the court said Congress could act, but no one thought they really would. So it was quite a surprise, actually, when they took it up. But the way they took it up is, a little bit surprising, especially coming out of the House, that none of the voter ID stuff made it in. A lot of us thought that might sort of be the price of doing business. And what they said was states or localities would be subject to preclearance if they had over five voting rights offenses over a 15-year period. So in some ways, that allows for taking a look at racial bias and states or localities that are doing things that are disparate treatment to minorities, but it doesn't have the same language, if you will, or the same symbolic resonance as Section 4 did.
It's Aaron O'Brien, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. So Aaron suggests that the way they've gone about this is kind of surprising, given the makeup of the Republican House particularly. Do you think Sensenbrenner here, the Wisconsin Republican, is part of the shaping of this approach?
Well, there's no question about that, and there's no question that he carries enormous weight in this coalition and will with conservatives and House Republican leadership. Without Sensenbrenner, this thing doesn't have a prayer. It may not actually already, but without him, there's no chance. Let's listen to him in his own words from just the other day, kind of describing how they put this coalition together and what it means.
What we were facing in drafting a modernization of the VRA was both a constitutional challenge, given the court's decision, as well as a political challenge in figuring out how to get the votes to pass this legislation in a divided and very fractured and partisan Congress. I think we have threaded that needle.
Now, he believes he's threaded that needle because they've compromised on the voter ID issue, which Aaron referred to a moment ago, which is anathema to liberals.
Right.
And they have embraced a formula which talks about offenses, as Aaron pointed out, not some sort of broader demographic kind of look.
That's right. And not a sense of history or an American sense of history that the South is segregationist,
right,
therefore all of the South gets preclearance. This is based on behavior, which a lot of Republicans...
Like points on your driver's license.
Points.
Kind of
that's a great way to look at it. And even a stricter standard for locations, which only have to have three violations. Also, the liberals like in this, it makes it... the simple way to say it, Aaron will correct me if I'm wrong, it makes it easier to sue, to get an injunction. It used to be in the old Voting Rights Act, it was very hard to go to court and get something stopped until the election was already over and it was too late. This lowers the legal bar so that if you think there's a problem in your jurisdiction, it's easier to get a stay, an injunction from the court, and get a ruling to stop a potential violation under this new proposal.
So, Aaron, does this thread the needle? Todd has said there is an uphill battle here politically. What do you make of it?
You know, I think it does, in part because of the surprise that they acted. So the left is disappointed because there isn't real discussion of race in there, but that the fact that they're doing anything is really, you know, the surprise. And if you've got both sides a little bit unhappy, then you probably are threading the needle.
And Todd, what do you think in terms of votes?
Well, really, really difficult to say conservatives are not very interested in dealing with this. This is really going to be a leadership call in the House Republican leadership. Now, Leahy said something important the other day. He said this is not something that is going to be filibustered in the Senate. Maybe he has an agreement. We asked him what that meant. He kind of shrugged it off. Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, is the one to watch. He's from the South. He's from Virginia. The exempting of voting rights laws, voter ID laws, which are rampant across the country, was the price to play for Cantor, but he hasn't signed on to the bill. If he does, that makes an enormous difference, but we don't know what he thinks yet.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. No snow day for you, right?
Oh, I'm down here. I'm not wearing a snowsuit or anything.
Aaron O'Brien, no snow day for you, right?
No, indeed.
All right. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, talking about the Voting Rights Act and the possibility that Congress would actually update the Voting Rights Act. All this hour, we're collecting your favorite memories of snow days when you were kids.
Hi, this is Bill. Today I'm calling from Wichita, Kansas. Growing up in the South, we didn't really have a lot of snow days, but on the last day of seventh grade in Southern California, a bunch of seniors ditched school that day, drove up to the top of Big Bear Mountain, and then drove back down and pelted us with snowballs that they had picked up at the top of the mountain.
Snow days, fond memories. Call us with yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway. Think of this now, 11 million pounds of chips, 80 million avocados. That's just some of the snack tonnage that will go down on Super Bowl Sunday. What does the concept of 80 million avocados actually look like? Well, if you piled them all together from goalpost to goalpost on a football field, it would make a guacamole casserole dish 12 feet deep. Which only goes to show you how little imagination Americans have when it comes to football chow, wings, nachos, pizza, guac, people. Let's get out of the rut, and let's help all those folks who will actually be at the game at MetLife Stadium in New Jersey dealing with the potential of a brutal Northeast winter. We got a taste of that today. With all of the snow, the prospect of the Super Bowl becoming the seriously chilly bowl is only making our takeaway recipe contest that much more urgent. Remember, the deal is this. We want recipes from you for some hot game-time chow that will fit in a bowl, soup or bowl. Get it? And we're going to pick some winners. Actually, Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast, will be doing the judging. Dan, welcome.
Hey, John. Yeah, I heard you say 80 million avocados. I thought you were reading one of the recipes from our contest.
That's great. Well, let's give people an update. We got this contest going until a couple of days before the Super Bowl. What are you seeing? Lay out the guidelines. We want to broaden people's imagination about game time food. What's our mission here?
Well, there are a lot of recipes coming in from all corners of the country, which is very exciting to see. And there is certainly some great variety and diversity in what we're seeing come through. But I would love to encourage people to show us an even wider range of what can be done here for the Super Bowl. I think we're certainly looking for dishes, as you said, that people are going might want to eat outside at the stadium, like a soup or a dish eaten in a bowl.
Right.
We want it to be hearty. But one thing that I should sort of clarify is that, you know, there's a difference between hearty and heavy. And, you know, we're talking platonic ideals of cold weather foods here. The dish should be hearty enough to restore me, but still light enough to energize me.
So there could be a restorative tomato soup that falls short of a couple of bricks in your stomach chili bowl.
That's right. Yeah, bricks in the stomach, not an attribute for this dish, because the Super Bowl, as we know, thanks to all the wonderful commercials, drags on for many, many hours. And I need to be able to still be able to jump up and down for a touchdown with 3 seconds to go in the game.
All right. So with keeping in mind that the Red Hot Chili Peppers will be performing at the halftime show, what spicy entries have we seen so far?
Well, you know, the truth is, John, there have not been a ton of spicy dishes. There are a lot that I think look like they will have some kick. You'll see a jalapeno here or there. You'll see a dash of Tabasco here or there. There's a mulligatawny on the list that looks quite promising. But I don't see many dishes where I think that it's leading with spice.
What is the least resembling soup recipe that you've seen so far?
Well, there's one called Like Lambs to the Slaughter, Shepherd's Pie.
Nice.
And that one is definitely nothing like a soup.
And you're not eligible to win, but if you were going to submit a recipe of your own, what kind of thing would you choose?
I'm painting with a broad brush when I say this, but something in the Asian soup family, because those tend to have a lighter broth, so it's not going to weigh me down so much, but they still have meat and or beans, bean sprouts. There's noodles in there. There's vegetables. There's a lot there and a lot of flavor. They're robust. They're hearty. They're warm, but they're also not going to make me feel like I need to fall asleep at halftime.
All right. Well, so you're getting some hints there, folks. So the deadline to submit is this Friday. Then you're going to go through all the recipes and we'll announce a winner sometime next week. How many winners?
There can only be one. It's like Highlander.
All right. Four finalists, one winner. Be one of the final four here at the Soup or Bowl Takeaway Contest. Dan, take care.
Thanks, John. It's a tough job.
Somebody's got to do it. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and it's a public versus private battle of the bus stops in the San Francisco Bay Area. The proliferation of company-owned shuttle services run by the likes of Google and Apple, transporting workers from the Bay Area to Silicon Valley and back, may be reducing traffic congestion, but they're also putting a strain on public city buses and creating delays, something San Francisco residents aren't too happy about. Last night, the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency voted unanimously to start a program to oversee and charge the tech companies a fee for using public bus facilities for their private employee shuttles. Joining us now is Isabel Angel, transportation reporter for KALW in San Francisco. Isabel, welcome.
Hi, John. It's great to be here.
How unprecedented is this to have a city charging a fee for private use of public bus stops? And what's the level of the fee that they approved?
Yeah, so I haven't really heard of anything like this before. They've come to this fee of $1 per bus per stop. And that's going to equal about $1.5 million annually. And basically, the agency says it's just to cover the cost of the program. They say they can't charge any more due to state law. And critics are pretty upset about this. They say, you know, it costs me $2 to use Muni, which is the bus system. So you should be charging $2 per person to ride these shuttles, or maybe $271 per stop, which is, you know, if I was driving a car and I stopped in a Muni stop, that's how much I could get a ticket for.
And part of the issue here is this is a story of transportation in the Bay Area, but it's also a story of the inequality in rents and cost of living in various places. People do have to travel long distances if they work in Silicon Valley or if they live in the valley and work in the city. Is that part of the story here?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a lot of these tech workers are moving into the city. They have a lot more money than people who, a lot of this is happening in the Mission, which is a neighborhood that historically has been a lot of immigrants, artists, generally low income, but it's pretty cool and hip and centrally located. So a lot of these young tech workers who are moving in are moving into the Mission and driving up the rent, just like the rest of San Francisco, and really changing the neighborhood. And these big buses, which cart the tech workers down to Silicon Valley, are kind of a big sign of that. They're these big double-decker buses. They come in on these streets. They weren't there before, and it's just a big sign of that.
And Google is making the dream of people like Crystal Schultz, who's a program manager for Google, a dream of living in the city, working in the valley, come true. Listen.
I moved to the Mission because I am a pedestrian. I don't own a car. I walk everywhere on the weekend, and I have relied on the shuttle since I've moved to San Francisco. This is a choice, I know, to live in San Francisco and to commute to Mountain View, but I wouldn't have it any other way. I see it as that I work in Mountain View, and I live in San Francisco.
So the personal utopian vision of Google employee Crystal Schultz is contrasted with the sort of political approach and concern about all this of Jane Martin, who's a political director for Power, which is a community organizing group that works on behalf of low-income and underserved San Francisco residents. Listen to Jane.
We're very concerned that the tech industry is privatizing public transit. We're concerned that the tech industry is using our public infrastructure and not giving enough back to the Muni system to provide the service that our communities so desperately need. We feel like the pilot doesn't achieve these goals. We think the tech industry can do more.
What do you think these two voices say about the Bay Area community, and who's going to win here before we go, Isabel?
So I think this really, they really represent the dichotomy of, you know, people who are moving into the city or who already live there but want the option to go down to the Silicon Valley in a free shuttle, and then the people who really don't like the changing city with getting more expensive. And it looks like so far the people who want to take those buses down to Silicon Valley are winning. Regulations passed yesterday and looks like they're here to stay.
So one for the Silicon Valley employees, and the city will have to wait till the next round. Isabel Angel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Isabel Angel is a transportation reporter for KALW in San Francisco.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The U.S. Constitution prohibits the state from sentencing people to cruel and unusual punishment. And this was part of the motivation to, over time in the United States, shift away from firing squads, hangings, and the electric chair to the use of lethal injection. But in the case of a convicted rapist and murderer, Dennis McGuire, it was his lethal injection delivered last week in Ohio that has been described as cruel and unusual.
The agony and terror of watching my dad suffocate to death lasted more than 19 minutes. It was the most awful moment in my life to witness my dad's execution. I can't think of any other way to describe it than torture.
That's Dennis McGuire's son speaking there. Now, one can easily imagine that watching one's father die by any manner of execution would be awful, but the effects of the particular chemicals given McGuire induced what seems to have been anything but a peaceful slide into some eternal rest.
His head kept coming up, and his mouth was wide open, and he's making all kinds of horrible noises. And it went on for a while. And I ended up stopping. I had to pull my hat over my head because I couldn't see it no more.
That is Amber McGuire, Dennis McGuire's daughter, describing what may have been a slow, chemically induced suffocation. This is something that was predicted in court testimony by anesthesiologist Dr. David Wiesel at Boston Children's Hospital. Dr. Wiesel joins us now. Welcome.
Hello, John.
Now, is chemically induced suffocation too strong of a word for what seems to have happened last Thursday?
Actually, it seems quite reasonable. He received chemicals, and he suffocated.
And in the expert testimony that you gave in advance of this execution, your concern was the particular chemicals did not prepare McGuire for what was going to happen to his body that actually killed him. Can you explain that?
Well, sure. So previously, up until now, the first drug in a lethal injection protocol was to anesthetize the inmate. This was a completely different approach, where there's to be some sedation of the inmate by midazolam, which is a drug like Valium, and then the inmate would be killed by a very large dose of a narcotic medication, somewhat like morphine, by basically drifting off and falling asleep. However, in Mr. McGuire's case, he had some characteristics that put him at great risk for not having a smooth drifting off to sleep from the narcotic medication, and thus we have what we have.
How has the political situation over the use of lethal injection drugs sort of shaken up the formula that's used here and made it unpredictable as to what chemicals are actually used? Why would a formula like this even be considered under any circumstances?
So for about 20 years ago, there's been a standard protocol of pentothal, which put the inmate to sleep, pancuronium, which is a muscle relaxant so the inmate wouldn't move, mostly for aesthetics, and potassium chloride to stop the heart. In the late 2000s, amid concerns that inmates were awake, based in part on a California case, the Bayes case from Kentucky went to the Supreme Court. Kentucky, in a very fractured decision, I think there were 7 opinions, ruled that Kentucky's protocol of pentothal, muscle relaxant, pancuronium, and potassium chloride was acceptable under the Constitution. About that time, the company that made pentothal decided not to make it anymore. That was in part because they moved their manufacturing plant to Italy. And the government in Italy said, if you make drugs used in lethal injection, we will hold your people here responsible. Several states tried to get pentothal in illegally, and that was stopped, and those drugs were taken away. But with pentothal running out, they went to another barbiturate called pentobarbital. And states took different courses. Some kept the drug to put them to sleep, the drug to paralyze them, and the drug to stop the heart. But others, notably Ohio, started a one-drug technique of just giving a large drug of pentobarbital. But now, the company that makes pentobarbital put controls on who could get it and have basically kept the states from not getting it for this purpose. In Ohio, they had a backup plan of intramuscular, midazolam, and hydromorphone, which is how we ended up here.
And it sounds to me as though Dennis McGuire was in a situation where he was faced with this particular cocktail of drugs, not because of any medical reason, but because of a kind of cat-and-mouse political game going on over the issue of capital punishment. Are medical people making the decisions of what chemicals are used here, or is it political decisions that are determining how people die by lethal injection?
The path I just described is clearly political. I know that no anesthesiologist is involved because we are not permitted. There's certainly evidence that in other states, physicians have been involved in designing protocols or in even participating in protocols. But in terms of Ohio, as far as I know, no physician was ever involved in building this protocol.
Talking with Dr. David Wiesel, an anesthesiologist at Boston Children's Hospital. He serves as an expert witness on death penalty drugs. And, you know, throughout your experience as an expert witness, you pride yourself on being emotionally detached, on not having your testimony about the behavior of drugs be influenced by whatever beliefs or, ideas you have about capital punishment. Is that fair?
True.
I'm wondering if this particular case and what happened to Dennis McGuire pushed you out of that in some way. What was your reaction to what happened here?
Initially, I was very, very angry. And then it settled into a deep sadness. And I think why I was more angry this time was this was so obvious. This was clearly going to happen. I told them this was going to happen. This didn't have to happen. And I think that's why I was so angry.
Dr. David Wiesel is an anesthesiologist at Boston Children's Hospital. He serves as an expert witness on death penalty drugs. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're interested in your response to that story or any story you hear on the program. You can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You find us at thetakeaway.org. You can share your comments. And to get an early jump on all of our conversations, join our listener response network by signing up for our texts. You'll get one text a day. We ask you a question featured on the next day's program, so your voice becomes part of our on-air conversation. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Let me tell you a little story. Down here in Washington, D.C. on Monday, where we've been broadcasting all week, it was warm and sunny and a holiday, Martin Luther King Day. Most federal employees had the day off. Yesterday, though, federal employees were also told to stay home, but it was not because of a holiday, it was because of the weather. Snow and falling temperatures caused Washington, D.C. to declare another snow emergency, canceling school and shutting down federal offices because of a few inches of snow. Yesterday, I and some members of the Commission for the White House Fellowships were visiting the snow-covered White House, which was not shut down. And in a short meeting with the president himself in the Roosevelt Room of the West Wing, this former resident of Chicago sort of rolled his eyes as he sauntered into the room and said that, quote, "I don't understand why my daughters are home from school today." In sort of a, "why, when I was a boy" moment with us, he commented on the weather-induced government shutdown, noting that he has some experience with government shutdowns of a political nature, which he certainly does. In Chicago, he told us, the government would never shut down when the snow falls, but he admitted that in D.C., the horrible traffic effects of weather might justify the precaution. Todd Zwillick is here with me in the studio. When I was talking to you about the weather reports, you know, like 36 hours ago, you were saying nobody even listens to that. Wrong-o.
Well, I said that I don't listen to it because I've learned long ago in this town that there is a great deal of weather hysteria. You know, I'm not in the business of endorsing President Obama, but I will tell you, he is absolutely correct in his frustration in this regard. I used to live in Montreal, where, as a source of pride, nothing ever shuts down. But this town, I love my town. I've lived here a long time, John. It's pathetic. People freeze up. At least this government snow shutdown had some snow. A couple of weeks ago, we had a couple of inches of rain, and people panicked. And on my way down to the studio to talk to you today, two people on the street in full snowsuits, jumpsuits as though they were about to get on lift 6 down at the ski slope. And there's a couple of inches of snow on the grounds. So I love my town, but Mr. President, gosh, you're right on this one.
Do you remember Snow Day in Montreal? A historic day when everyone shut everything down?
No, in college there was only one shutdown my entire career, and it was because of temperature, minus 40, not snow. However, Hershey, Pennsylvania, where I grew up, we had a couple a year, and they were the best. Snow up to our waists. I remember trudging through with my sister. There was a tennis tournament in town, a semi-professional tournament. We used to be ball kids for the tournament. It didn't shut down, and we had to walk 4 miles in the snow to get there, but we did. We trudged through with my mom to be on the court on time.
young geezer Todd Zwillick, also Takeaway Washington correspondent on memories of snow days. Thanks, Todd.
Sure.
So what kind of community do you live in? A snow-averse, emergency-prone, snow-days-are-us kind of place like Washington, D.C., or a tough, never-shut-down Chicago, Montreal-like place where a snow day was more memorable, a bit of history? Lester Laminack wrote the book on the joys and memories of snow days, quite literally. Lester is professor of education at Western Carolina University and author of the children's book, Snow Day. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
How magical are snow days, and why do you think this book really, really connected with people?
I think it captures the fascination with the potential of a snow day more so than the actual day itself. When the weatherman calls for snow, and children start anticipating that day off and the things they're going to do. And when I wrote the book, it was prompted by a remark made by a fourth grade teacher who was upset with the weatherman because he had called for snow and it didn't happen, which got me to remembering my own snow days as a child and as a teacher, and I was fascinated by the notion that the teachers were just as excited by snow days as are the children. So it was something that captured that imagination.
Where did you grow up, and where are the memories of your snow days from?
I grew up in Alabama, in the northeastern corner of Alabama, the highest elevation of the state and pretty far south. So you didn't get very many snow days, and when we did get a snow day, it was a magical event. My Aunt Betty would wrap our feet up in plastic bags and put rubber bands around them and trudge us around town just so we could see it all. And it only takes a few flakes in Alabama to close school.
So you're definitely from the snow-averse part of the world. But there is a magic in the South where snow is a possibility. But it's also possible that you could grow up and never see snow in your own backyard, right?
Now, that's true. Now, currently, I live in Asheville, North Carolina, and we have a few snowflakes this morning and some pretty cold temperatures for what people think of the South. And we see a good bit of snow here in the mountains.
And, you know, the snow day for an adult is very, very different than a snow day for kids. Snow days are all about, like, going outside. For adults, it's all about childcare.
That's absolutely true. We'll have schools that are closed, and, you know, I'm sure the first thought in the parents' mind is, what do we do with these children today?
We're talking with Lester Laminack, who wrote the book Snow Day. I don't want to get all public radio on you here, and it seems as though even in a moment of climate change, we've seen a lot of polar vortexes all over the east coast of North America. But are you ever worried that, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, people will look at your book and go, snow day? What's he talking about?
You know what? I'm hoping 50 years from now, 100 years from now, people are still looking at that book. That would be delightful. I'm not sure, because we keep talking about things happening with the weather, but snow keeps coming and it still gets colder. So I'm not sure what to think about this weather.
In your own Western Carolina University classrooms, how do kids respond, or how do students respond to the idea of what you wrote in Snow Day years ago?
I think everybody, regardless of age, finds a little thrill in a snow day and the potential of what that might bring. And then when the reality comes, it's a little bit of an issue. I actually was supposed to be in a school as a visiting author today in South Carolina, and they looked at the weather forecast for where I live and decided to postpone because they were concerned I wouldn't make it down the mountain. And they might have been right.
Lester Laminack wrote the book, children's book, Snow Day. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Lots of you out there have remembrances of snow days from a long time ago. Here's one. It's a great one from 1976, Bothell, Washington. We lived in Tehran. I attended the Tehran American School. The snow must have started falling during the school day, and my friend and I started playing in the snow as we waited for the bus to head to our respective homes. Well, we had tons of fun in the snow and completely missed the bus, so imagine my mother's panic when the bus never appeared at our door to drop me off. Eventually, we were driven home in the personal car of the Iranian transportation manager.
Kyle, I'm calling from Portland, Oregon, but this story took place in Seattle, Washington, back in the 80s. This one day, the school bus, when I got on, I sort of sat for a while with the driver, and it was just us, and then we finally realized that school was going to be 2 hours late, and there I was stuck on the bus. It was an older guy, older African-American guy who was driving, and I wish I could remember his name, because I always remember this moment where he decided that we would lock up the bus, which itself was pretty exciting, and we went across the street, and he bought me a pancake breakfast, and we sat for the 2 hours it took to wait out the late start for school. I loved it.
A 1967 memory from one of you in Portland, Oregon. We lived in San Diego, and it snowed. I remember looking out the window from my third-grade classroom, and all of us were astonished and begged our teacher to dismiss the class so we could take early recess to play in the snow. She said, "Yes, fine, but you have to finish your math first." Of course, we all worked as fast as we could, which was probably a half hour, all the while looking out the window and back to our work. The flakes were huge. It kept snowing and snowing. I'm thinking snowball fights, sleds, snowmen. We got done, and good to her word, she let us out. As we burst through the school doors out to the playground, ready to have some fun, we all stopped and realized the snow had melted before we could get out to enjoy it. Share your snow day snapshot stories with us at 877-8MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.